and found 40-caliber shells rattling around the box's bottom. One by one, she fed them into the magazine, and when it was loaded, she stuck the gun under her shirt. If her mother was awake upstairs, she didn't want to have to explain anything. But her mother wasn't awake. Laura had pulled on hiking boots and slipped out the door, into the waiting car. In no time at all, they were gone. The Browning hung like a lead weight in her pocket. She tried not to let it bang on the nearby tree as she shifted her weight. Below them was a large natural bowl carved into the Blue Ridge Mountains. It was too small and shallow to be called a valley, too round to be a canyon. It was almost perfectly circular, with steep walls rising about 100 feet above the floor and a flat bottom covered in widely spaced pines. In the center, located directly on top of the message's coordinates, stood a cabin. It looked to be one or two rooms, built of rough, unfinished planks and cross-hatched logs. Barely visible behind it was the top of a small outbuilding. A rutted dirt track led in down the shallow side of the bowl, but there were no cars in sight.
"Where's Deputy Stewart? You said he'd be here," Leon said.
"He left 30 minutes before us. Maybe he got lost." Leon shrugged. It wasn't impossible. They had never managed to find a spot where the dirt track leading to the cabin connected to any larger road. After driving back and forth a few times, they had simply pulled over and started through the woods on foot, heading toward the coordinates. Eventually, they'd hit the edge of the bowl.
"Maybe he's not coming," Leon said.
"I don't think he'd give up that easily." Leon shrugged again.
"You know him a lot better than I do. What about the light, though?"
She looked behind them at the sky. They'd left it about 3:30, and now it was almost 7:30. The sun hovered dangerously close to the horizon. Leon followed the direction of her gaze.
"Could be he realizes how close we are to sunset. Maybe he turned back."
"Maybe," Laura said, and remembered another trick from her time outdoors with her father. She held up her right hand, index and middle fingers extended and pressed together, pointing to her left. It looked like she was making a gun and turning it sideways. Held up to the sky, the arc length of 2 fingers was about equal to the distance the sun would travel in 30 minutes. She made another gun with her left hand and, starting at the sun, walked her fingers down to the horizon. She counted 2 30-minute spans, plus a little extra, 1 hour and 15 minutes. Down in the bottom of the bowl, though, sunset would come earlier. It may only be light down there for another 30 minutes or so. Opposite them, on the east side, fog started flowing over the rim and pouring down into the bottom. It crept across the floor of the bowl, snaking between the trees, filling it up with a thin mist. The setting sun infused the murk with a faint orange glow, the air smoldering from within. Beside her, Leon shivered.
"You ever see anything like that?"
"Fog in the mountain? Sure."
"No, like that. Fucking orange mist. It looks like goddamn Halloween down there."
It was the first time she'd ever heard him swear, but it sure as hell didn't seem like the right time to dish out a lesson in manners.
"No, I guess not," she conceded. "And this is where you think a fucking serial killer is hiding?"
"Cold feet?" she asked again and tried for a grin. As far as coercion went, it sounded weak even to her. Leon gritted his teeth.
"You know what? Yeah, I think my feet are feeling a little frosty."
"We've come this far. We can't turn back now."
"Speak for yourself," he said, and started zipping up his camera bag.
"Leon." He started buckling straps, getting ready to move. "Leon, look at me." She reached out and put a hand on his arm. He froze, and even in the fading light, she could see the fine hairs on the back of his arm stand up. He looked at her. "Leon, do it for me," she said. "Look, I'm not saying we go down there, okay? Let's just watch and see what we can see. It's probably just a cabin anyway." He wavered, then shrugged again.
"Fine, but there is no way I'm going down that hill."
"Thank you." She took her hand off his arm and went back to watching the cabin. "But at least get some shots while we're up here." He unzipped his bag and assembled his camera, the same 35mm with attached zoom lens he'd had with him on the ridge near Hillsboro, and started snapping pictures. "Any good?" she asked after a while.
okay, I think. Usually the sunset makes for great light, but with that mist filtering through everything, I'm not sure. Just do your best. They waited another 10 minutes before the headlights appeared. Laura noticed them first as a faint glow. There hadn't been time to find a pair of binoculars, so she had a much wider field of view than Leon, who had his eye glued to the viewfinder. Hey, she nudged him in the ribs. Over there. They both tried to crouch a little lower. The headlights bounced over the edge of the bowl and down the track, cutting veins through the mist, and stopped 50 yards shy of the cabin. Give me that, Laura said and picked up the camera. She used it as a makeshift telescope trained down toward the lights. I want to see this car. But it wasn't a car. It was a truck. Shit, she muttered. Leon couldn't take the suspense of not knowing. Questions poured out of him rapid fire. Who is it? Is it him? Is it the kid? What does he look like? It's Frank, she hissed. He matched her volume and started whispering again. Deputy Stewart? Through the viewfinder, she saw him open his door, then quickly reach up and turn off his dome light. He climbed out and moved around to the hood, leaving the driver's side door open behind him. He had pulled an open flannel shirt over his tank top. In his hand, she could see something black and boxy. His gun. He's armed, she whispered. As she said it, he gripped the gun in both hands, pointed it at the ground, and started jogging toward the cabin. He moved lightly from tree to tree, getting closer by the second. At the last tree, he broke into a sprint, ran right at the house, and slid to a stop with his back against the planks, his chest heaving up and down. What do we do? Leon asked. Nothing, Laura said. She couldn't think of a way to get down off the edge of the bowl. Leon had refused to move, and Frank had no idea she was up here. If she tromped down the side after him, he might well turn and shoot before they could even exchange a word. She dropped her eye to the camera again. It was almost like watching a movie. Below them, the tiny version of Frank went into a crouch and crab walked along the base of the wall. At the window, he stopped, raised his head, peered inside. It must not have been interesting because he dropped down and kept moving. In another second, he disappeared around the corner. I can't see him, she said. What do you mean? He's behind the cabin. They waited. The seconds ticked past. Is he still back there? Yes, Laura breathed. It's been too long. Maybe we should do something. You're not going down there. I thought you wanted to go down there, he muttered. That was before Frank was running around with a gun. We could try to call him. Leon pulled out his phone and unlocked the screen, then shook his head. No service up here. Down below, Frank emerged around the far corner and worked his way around to the front. At the cabin door, he reached up and jiggled the knob. He's back. The door swung open. It's unlocked, she whispered. Let me see. Just hold on. Frank flexed his legs and came to standing. Leaned over to peer into the door, then moved inside with the gun extended in front of him. The darkness inside swallowed him up. He's inside. They waited. Oh, God, Leon said. He'll be fine. He grabbed her by the arm. What? She hissed. Over there, he said, and the tremble in his voice made her pay attention. She tore her eye off the viewfinder and followed his finger to a spot 100 feet left of the house. Nothing there. What? She hissed again. Something moved. Where? Right there. She panned the zoom lens left and peered through. Nothing but leaves and pine needles and logs. A perfectly ordinary forest floor. You're seeing things. There's nothing. Something moved. As she watched, a section of leaves slid downward, funneling into some kind of hole. The forest floor moved like quicksand, opening like a mouth, the ground itself sinking until it disappeared. And then it rose out of the hole. A figure in black, hooded, slim, and tall and quick. He appeared from beneath the ground like a devil and bolted toward the cabin. Something strange about his gait. It looked like he was gliding. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. Laura wondered who was talking, realized it was herself. What do we do? Leon said. Without thinking, she cupped her hands around her mouth and shouted, Frank! The figure in black snapped its head around, looked right at them, and Laura felt her blood turn to ice. Oh, Jesus, he sees us! Leon grunted and buried his face in the ground. Frank! She yelled again. No movement inside. The figure turned away from them, charged forward again, faster now, flying toward the cabin. Frank! She screamed. And then the figure disappeared inside. For a second, nothing happened. Laura clenched her fists, squeezed her eyes open and shut, tried not to panic. Then that familiar sound, much sharper at a distance. Crack, crack, crack! Three gunshots fired in quick succession. She didn't think, didn't even react. Fear, the same fear she'd struggled all her life to keep locked in a box deep inside her chest, suddenly didn't seem to matter. It crumpled off of her like a tissue paper dress, caught in a driving rain. Laura burst out of the brush at full speed, over the lip, the decision somehow made even though she couldn't remember making it. And then she was flying down the slope, arms pumping, the Browning like a 5-pound dumbbell swinging back and forth with dangerous intensity. Rocks and logs appearing and then passing under her like water. And then the flat bottom of the bowl rose up to meet her, and the surprising flatness, the sudden loss of gravity's assistance, made it feel like running through molasses. And she pumped her arms harder, the lethal weight in her hand making her bicep burn, the cabin growing until she could almost reach out and touch it. And everything else, every fear and whim and care, dropped away until the only sensations left to her were the mist sliding past her skin like oil and the steady burn of cool mountain air on the inside of her lungs. Crack! The sound blistered her eardrums from several directions at once, and she realized it was an echo. The curvature of the bowl bouncing reports at her from several directions. The door was close now. Crack! Old wood splintered a hole into the door, and something reached out and bit her on the hip. She slid to a stop, raised the Browning into the A-frame stance her father had beat into her, fired twice quickly, the big 40-caliber slugs tearing apple-sized holes in the door. And then she turned sideways and threw herself down behind a pine tree. The world went very quiet. And then it started to buzz. She tweaked one ear, trying to fix it, but the gunshots had temporarily ruined her hearing. She became uncomfortably aware that someone could have walked out the cabin door, could be standing behind her right now, and she would never hear a thing. She twisted at the waist, forced herself to look. No one there. She waited like that, tugging an earlobe every few seconds, giving them the time to heal themselves. And they did. Second by second, sound returned. After 2 minutes, she could hear the birds chirping in the trees, undisturbed by the evening's violence. He, the cry choked off before it had even begun. Hey, help. Either way, she was sure it came from somewhere in front of her. She came around the side of the tree and jogged the last 20 feet to the cabin's front door, then looked through one of the bullet holes. It was dark inside, the light of the sun nearly gone, but she could make out the major details. The inside appeared to be split into two small rooms, with the door opening into the hallway that ran front to back between them. No sign of Frank, no sign of the hooded figure. She pushed the door open with the muzzle of the Browning, slid in between the door and the frame, then ducked into the room on the left. She walked a few feet farther in, surveying the space. Without warning, the room's door slammed shut behind her, followed by the rapid scrape of wood on wood. She raised the Browning, pulled the trigger, and it jammed. A tired spring in the magazine, maybe, or her own sweat and dirt clogging the mechanism. Or maybe it was the years of disuse. Maybe it was a miracle it had fired at all. Tears were streaming down her face, even though she couldn't remember starting to cry. She was only vaguely aware of them falling onto her hands as she tried to work the gun's action, and when that failed, to pry the breech open with her fingernails. One nail ripped, then another. In a moment of pure frustration, she whipped the 5-pound chunk of metal against the door, a final fuck you to whoever was out there. To her surprise, it took out a chunk of wood. She ran a finger across the hole and felt the damp deep inside, rotten to the core. The room was empty save a bed frame without a mattress, and hanging from one wall some rusted farm implements. She chose a short-handled pickaxe and reached for it, then winced at the pain at her side. Blood seeped from a wound just above her left hip. She pressed on it, winced again, and tried to forget it was there. The pickaxe came away from the wall, and she swung the blunt end against the door, then again and again. Lumps of wet pine showered her face and chest. Her arms shrieked in protest, but she kept up the blows, punching the metal wedge through the barrier with all the strength she could muster. The door groaned once more before giving way. She was out. A scream from somewhere at the end of the hall. No, it was too far away, from behind the house. A back door? She reached the end of the hall, her hands searching, finding the knob. She ripped the door open and hurtled out. A blinding flash rose to greet her, followed by a familiar roar. Splinters exploded through the air, and she found herself down in the leaves, unable to hear, unable to see. Waking up was like clawing her way out of a hole, and it felt like it took hours. No, it couldn't have taken that long. When she opened her eyes, the smell of gunpowder still hung in the air. She opened her eyes. "Frank," she said and sat up. All over her body, a million tiny cuts. She ran a hand down one arm and felt miniature toothpicks sticking out of her, hundreds of them. She pulled one out and blood flowed. "Frank," she said again and stood. He wasn't difficult to find. Less than 30 feet away, he leaned against a tree, a smile open across his abdomen, eyes dead, the glass doll's eyes of something no longer animate. "Frank," she walked to him, every step like torture, wetness flowing down her skin, soaking into her clothes. Then she saw the mask, a black hood with crude eye holes cut into it. Frank was clutching it in one hand. He was close. She took another step, stopped. At her feet lay the remains of the hooded figure. He was just beside the tree, spread eagle in the grass, shotgun by his side. Even now, one hand held to it tightly. One finger still slipped through the trigger guard. His feet were bare, and his face was missing. It had been totally and completely annihilated. She walked between them, turned back, and stared down at the grass. Frozen. Stood like that until the pain forced her to her knees. She took Frank's hand and held it, squeezed it, and waited for him to squeeze back. She waited like that for a long time, room at last inside her to be afraid. Nothing left to fill it with but grief. Part 2. Never a Trace of Red. Chapter 21. The dart was mostly fixed. She'd killed more than a few days working on it herself, using the barn as a makeshift garage, and it was running better than ever. The radio still shorted out from time to time, and the ignition was sticking again in the cold weather. The heater didn't work for shit. So she shivered a little and pulled her coat tight as she braked, the whistling wind dying down to a hum. The radio had gone out a few minutes prior, and it crackled back to life as she bounced off the highway and onto the dirt track the Chambers family called a driveway. "Front continues moving in from the northwest. It's a chilly one, and temperatures are going to stay cold the next few days. Next Monday is Christmas, and things may warm up before then. The real anticipation is centered on the warmer, wetter air moving in from the southwest. If nothing changes, we may see several inches of snow this weekend. Other possible." Laura clicked off the radio and collected the shopping bags out of the back seat. She pushed the door open with her hip and used her foot to shove it closed behind her. She glanced down at the entryway table at the stack of mail. And that's when she saw the picture. She recognized it right away. The picture had run in many papers, but this version was quite large. Laura was nearly certain this one had been cut out of the News and Observer from July 12th, 2 days after the cabin, when they'd run it on the front page. It had been folded in half once to fit in the plain white envelope still underneath it. The envelope had her name and address printed in neat block letters, and the postmark was from Charlotte. There was no return address. She shifted the bags to one arm and snagged the picture between two fingers before pushing through into the kitchen and settling the shopping on the counter. Her mother was in the living room, reclined in her Barca lounger, her stories blaring on the television. "Mama, this came in the mail?" Diane grunted. "It's been opened." She turned slightly in the chair. "It's my house, isn't it?" Laura bit her lip, then asked, "Was there anything else in the envelope?" "I didn't see anything." She shouted it over the hospital scene playing out on Days of Our Lives. "Maybe you could turn it down a bit." Her mother twisted her bulk, the chair squealing in protest. "Don't you take that tone with me, Missy, and wipe that look off your face, like you just been slapped. If seeing that picture again upsets you so, tell your friend not to send clippings."
"It's not from my friend," Laura said.
"Oh, no? Who else would it be?"
"Not someone who likes me," Diane huffed.
"Who could, after all that?"
Laura saw her mother with rare clarity in that moment. "You're supposed to," she said. "You're my mother."
"I love you, dear, but I don't have to like you."
"What should I have done? Left that girl to die?" Diane wrung her hands, looking very much like a bit player on her soap opera.
"Oh, Laura, she was already dead."
"We don't know that."
"And Frank died because of your so-called help. That's two dead instead of one. Seems to me the math is real clear."
She turned back to the TV, and Laura let herself back out onto the porch, hands shaking. The picture's edge sliced into the vulnerable flesh between her forefinger and thumb, and she jumped as though bitten. She peeled her eyes away from the opening cut and looked up, out over the large and empty fields. They extended away from the house in every direction, besides a small stand of river birch shading the area between the house and barn. There wasn't a single tree within 300 yards of this spot. The fields extended 2 miles behind her, until they ran into another farm of similar size, and the driveway extended almost a mile before connecting with the highway. One grimy plastic chair lived at the end of the porch. She sat and held up her hand to the light. A red globule of blood hung from fleshy skin, perfectly round, unmoving. Certain people had a total inability to stand the sight of blood, but Laura had acquired a different aversion, the taste. For almost 6 months, she had assiduously avoided even the aroma of blood. She'd spent 6 months hiding from the crackling fat of rare steaks, 6 months dodging anyone with a bloody nose, 6 months flossing regularly and gently, careful of her gums. Anything to avoid tasting it again. She considered going inside for a bandage, but in that moment she couldn't stand the thought of showing her belly, even in such an insignificant way. Disgust at her own weakness welled in the back of her throat. All this time, people had been looking at her like she'd collapse at the first sign of difficulty. And even when she was alone, a sense of self-doubt and a lingering fragility gnawed at her insides. She'd catch glimpses of her face in the mirror and shudder at the frailty she saw written in her expression. Because she wasn't delicate, not deep down inside. She wasn't a breakable thing, not before and not now. But nothing she'd done in the last 6 months had proved otherwise to the people around her, or to herself. Right then, right there on her front porch, she started to get angry. She studied her hand, and then, before she could talk herself out of it, pressed the drop to her mouth and sucked the cut dry. Her throat started to close up, but she forced herself to breathe through her nose, and then to swallow. The taste was just as she remembered it. The same as behind the cabin, when it hung so thick in the air she thought she would choke. Wrapping up all the loose ends had happened faster than she ever would have expected. The mysterious, multicolored twine used to bind the victims was tucked away in the other room of the cabin. A large spool of it, apparently handmade. Olive Hansen and the three girls from 1988 had been bound up in identical sky blues and summer greens. There was no question in anyone's mind that the physical evidence was a match. And they had been able to identify the kid. His face had been blown off, but his fingerprints were perfectly intact, and a match to an old military service record. Leon Botan was the one who'd sold the picture to the Raleigh News and Observer,
and it dominated the front page. Over the past 6 months, it had been reprinted in magazines and other major dailies more times than she could count. Laura had never gotten the chance to write the article underneath it. After the cabin, she'd spent 24 hours in the hospital with a police guard on a room, and once her fingernails and the cut on her hip had been patched, another 8 hours in an interview room before they'd allowed her to leave. News traveled fast, so by then it was already too late. Smythe ended up writing the story, packing it with twists and turns and all the navel-gazing speculation about the nature of the human condition that played so well with the general public. It was his name below all the headlines, so when they called, the job offer was for him. They, in this case, turned out to be the LA Times. 2 months after it all blew up, Smythe was on a plane headed for California. Frank Stewart's funeral had been exactly 1 week after that Monday in the mountains. The whole town turned out. Laura had stood at the very back in dark glasses, trying for anonymity and failing miserably. The energy in the cemetery soured the second she entered. Backs went stiff. The crowd went silent. Not a single person looked at her. Everyone saw her. Leaving would be a tacit admission of guilt, and she refused to cry in front of the bastards. So she stayed put until the box was in the ground, never letting out so much as a sniffle. Already she could imagine them gathering after he was buried, drinking and trading stories. Eventually the gossip would turn in her direction. "That Chambers is an ice-cold bitch. Got him killed and didn't even shed a tear." It didn't matter. She wouldn't give them the satisfaction. Sometime during the minister's remarks, the bandage on her hip soaked through and blood started running down her leg. She kept her hand pressed on the wound and thanked God she was wearing black. On the porch, cold wind sliced and hummed between the plastic rails of her chair. She pulled the cut out of her mouth and examined it. Her eyes dropped into her lap and found the picture again. She couldn't escape it. It was like a curse. For perhaps the thousandth time she studied it. This time it was the composition that struck her most. The way things were organized into a perfect triangle. She occupied the top of the space. Frank was in the middle right, and a pair of legs ending in black boots were perfectly visible, sticking into the frame at about middle left. The angle was from down low, the dry leaves and pine needles shrinking back into the shot, providing the needed perspective. It made the viewer feel detached, but also godlike, omniscient, privy to everything, a fly on the wall, the connoisseur of a voyeuristic dream, but powerless to affect any of the players. The figures in the picture looked close enough to touch, but somehow distant, too. Beyond saving. Leon, Laura later learned, had found his courage up at the top of the bowl. It had taken him a bit longer, but in a way, that only increased her respect. Her reaction had been instinct, nothing more. She hadn't bothered to dwell on her own mortality before climbing over the edge. Leon had done that and more. He had followed her through the woods and into the cabin, armed only with his camera. Despite gunfire, he had gone out the back door, taken a knee, and clicked the shutter. It was the only picture he took. She tore herself away from the figures, but her eyes danced back again. Was this the purpose of sending the pictures? So that she could never look away? Frank appeared almost dignified, his face cast down, his arms in his lap, like he'd just discovered the damage to his abdomen. On the other side were the remains of the kid. Laura hovered above them both, motionless. She was the undeniable center of the image, the source of its inherent drama. Feet shoulder-width apart, shoulders back, head erect, back straight, the picture of perfect posture. Blood streamed off the tips of her fingers. They told her later at the hospital that she'd torn off 4 of her fingernails, and smeared her cheeks with gruesome blush. Clothes clotted and black at her hip. Hair matted, throat stained a darkening crimson. Even now Laura couldn't remember exactly what she had been thinking and feeling. Her head was angled down, the eyes cast up under her brow. She looked directly into the camera, pinning the viewer to a wall, her gaze an unearthly mix of solemnity and rage. Behind her, the last rays of sunset shot through the mist, imbuing it with that preternatural orange glow. She seemed a creature, more mythological than human,
the vampire queen, the darkling angel, the avatar of death. It was a one-in-a-million shot. So perfect, it looked staged. Only police reports convinced the world of its veracity. To Lara, the purpose of sending it seemed perfectly clear. The picture was a message, one she was receiving loud and clear. It said, "I haven't forgotten about you." She let herself stare at it for another second, then tore it into little pieces and carried them to the garbage can. It was 20 yards away, leaned against the side of a shed. She jogged to it, the horizon looming large in the distance, pressing in on her from all 360 degrees. That feeling of being watched had returned. A prickly sensation burned on the back of her neck, and some ancient reptilian part of her brain roiled with alarm. She took a deep breath, tried to shake the feeling, told herself it was nothing. She went back into the house and locked the door behind her. Chapter 22. "That's good, Laura. Keep going, please." "There's nothing else to say."
"That's all? The story just ends?"
"It happened quick. Have you ever been in a situation like that? Where time slows down?" Jasmine Devane took a minute to consider.
"Well, I've been in a few car accidents. I know the feeling you mean, where everything seems to happen in slow motion."
"Exactly.
But we're not in slow motion now. We're taking it beat by beat.
After you found Frank along with, don't say his name.
After you found Frank with, I asked you not to say his name."
Lara pushed herself up and went to the table by the window.
"Please.
I know it's difficult to talk about."
Lara lifted a glass set out next to a decanter of water.
"This clean?"
Jasmine nodded.
She poured herself water, drank it down, poured again, and returned to her seat.
"I'm sorry, I should have offered you some. You're the patient, I'm the therapist. You're not supposed to get me things. You don't have to feel bad when you don't."
"I don't feel bad, that is. It's just a question of manners."
"So, you're behind the cabin?"
"Like, for example, basic manners would be that if a patient says she doesn't want to talk about something, maybe you would just let it go."
Jasmine tapped her pen against one tooth.
"I see your point."
"You do?"
"Absolutely. I mean, that's life's endeavor in a way, the avoidance of pain. Why hurt when you don't have to?"
"Preach it, sister."
"But there are flaws in that point of view. You're missing some of the nuance of human psychology."
"Educate me, oh wise one."
Jasmine grinned. This teacher-student shtick had been going on between them for a while, but it still made both of them smile. In truth, Lara was fascinated by Jasmine's job and by the entire field of psychology. Only when the conversation shifted to Lara's personal neuroses did things turn icy between them.
Jasmine said, "You joke, but I'm serious. We're talking about instant gratification here, something to which all people, and monkeys and other animals, are prone. You don't talk about this bad thing that happened to you, so you avoid the pain of reliving it. That's good, right?"
"Feels pretty good."
Jasmine shook her head.
"Not right at all. You're just passing the buck, handing it to the future version of yourself. It's a lot like procrastination. Every day you put it off until tomorrow, and it never gets done. You never get better. If we can't even mention, don't say his name."
Lara said again, "I just don't like hearing it."
"Okay."
Jasmine conceded.
"Okay.
So can we talk about something else?"
"Absolutely not."
"Are you sure? My mother's been a real bitch these past few days."
Jasmine grinned again.
"Maybe in a bit."
Lara crossed her arms on her chest.
"I just don't understand what talking will accomplish. It won't change anything."
"The therapeutic benefits of talking are myriad. There's no point blabbing about it."
Jasmine made a circle with her hand, a gesture inclusive of the couch and the chairs and the bookshelves and the heavy drapes.
"There's no point in talking about it. All we do in here is talk about things. I mean, that's a pretty fair definition of therapy, isn't it? Coming to a place to talk about your problems?"
Lara said nothing.
"What's worse?"
Jasmine continued.
is that you believe in therapy, Laura. I'm not your first therapist, and you were seeing me a long time before. She caught herself. Didn't say the name. Laura uncrossed her arms. Meaning what? Meaning you're rationalizing. You're taking issue with the whole therapeutic process. But really, it's a lot simpler than that. You went through a traumatic experience, and now you want to avoid talking about it. You'd understand if you'd been there. Jasmine sighed. How are you sleeping? Fine, Laura said, and knew the doctor could tell she was lying. The bags under her eyes were impossible to hide. A lack of sleep can only exacerbate your other symptoms. How's the paranoia?
It's not paranoia.
Are you still getting the feeling that someone is watching you?
It's not just a feeling, Jasmine.
You know what I got today? Another one of those damn pictures in the mail. Went out to the grocery store, where no one can look me in the eye, by the way, and came back to that shit.
Do you think they're related?
Laura's brow wrinkled.
What and what?
The fact that you think no one looks you in the eye at the grocery store. And the picture.
Laura heard a slight inflection on the word think. You think no one looks you in the eye.
No one looks me in the eye, she repeated. I'm not being paranoid.
We can talk about that too, but I'm saying, let's take it at face value, okay?
People in this town are eager to gossip and slow to forget. I get that. So maybe it's all part of the same thing.
You mean someone is sending the picture again and again as some sort of punishment?
Jasmine shook her head.
That's not the word I choose. Punishment is deserved. This is harassment, intimidation.
And do you think someone in town is doing that to me?
It's possible. I also think it's possible that if we could talk to the person doing it, they would describe it as a prank or a joke, though that's just another creeping rationalization.
Laura turned and looked out the window. Maybe, she said finally.
Can I ask you something else?
It's therapy, Doc. You don't have to ask me if you can ask me questions.
Well, let me preface this one. I'm not making a suggestion or encouraging you. In fact, it would make me sad to see you go.
But I'm wondering, why are you still here?
I thought we were friends.
Jasmine nodded.
We are. But as your friend, I want what's best for you. And I know you're not blind to all the adversity you face around here.
People didn't take Frank Stewart's death very well.
Laura snorted. That's an understatement.
You have to understand, in these kinds of situations, people look for someone to blame.
He went up there on his own.
I know. You've told me that part of the story 100 times.
I didn't make him go.
Of course not. You can't make anyone do anything. We're responsible for our own decisions.
And I wouldn't change a thing,
Laura said.
If I could go back, there isn't a single decision I would change. I did the right thing. I tried to contact the police, but no one believed me. Was I supposed to do nothing? Was I supposed to sit by and let that little girl die? She could have been alive in that cabin. She could have been alive and screaming, waiting for someone to help her.
The words poured out of her. She couldn't stop them.
She might still be alive, somewhere.
Jasmine reached out and put a hand on her patient's arm.
You need to cling to that. The fact you wouldn't change a thing. You need to remind yourself of it every day. You didn't make a mistake. Frank Stewart did. Take solace in the belief you made the right choices.
It doesn't feel like I made the right choices, Laura said.
Our choices aren't everything. Sometimes things in the world just happen.
Doesn't feel like anyone else thinks I made the right choices either.
That's different, Jasmine said. That's about casting blame.
And I know this isn't fair, but they cannot, will not, put the blame on Frank Stewart. No one wants to think ill of the dead.
So it has to be me.
Jasmine shrugged.
Who else?
And she was right. It was just that simple. Who else? Who had set everything in motion? Besides a high schooler armed only with a camera, who else had walked out of those mountains alive?
So that's what I mean when I ask why you're still here, Jasmine said.
I don't think you did anything wrong, but most people around here will never agree. Life will be difficult for you. You left once before. Why not again? Laura craned her head back to look at the ceiling. Laura? I don't know.
Your mother?
So now's a good time to talk about Diane. Jasmine threw up her hands.
I get it. You don't want to talk about this.
But you must. Can we go back to the cabin? Laura squeezed her eyes shut, shook her head.
Does that help?
What?
Closing your eyes.
You know it doesn't help, not at all.
No, she said. If closing your eyes helped, you'd be able to sleep.
Laura opened her eyes.
I don't want to talk about the cabin.
We've been over the story again and again. No one believes you, so you drive up there. The bowl in the woods, going into the cabin, opening the back door.
Yes.
And then you stop. The story just ends.
That's what stories do. They end.
That's not an ending, Laura. Me and about half the world, it seems, read the story in every paper for a month. You find the bodies out back, and then you go back inside.
Laura said nothing.
To look for Teresa Mitchum.
Laura pulled her knees up to her chest, squeezed them too. Maybe if she squeezed long enough and hard enough, she'd curl up into a tiny ball and just disappear.
But you didn't find her, Jasmine finished, did you?
Some hot part of Laura's brain went cold. It had been happening more and more lately, like flipping a safety switch. The horror and fear and anger and shame would swell in her chest, and just when there should have been a climax, an explosion, her insides would turn to ice. She felt like a robot, but that didn't bother her, anything to be free of herself. When she spoke again, her voice sounded distant and flat.
I don't want to talk about this anymore, Dr. Devane.
Jasmine seemed to sense the change in her.
I know you don't, Laura, I know.
And just as quickly, the rage burned bright again. It had lingered inside her, nourished by the ember of her guilt until it could catch fire once more.
You know? You know?
She yelled. The nearest small object was her water glass. She hurled it against the brick wall and watched the shards rain down. Jasmine Devane was quiet. She was wise enough to let silence do the talking.
I'm sorry, she said.
I know.
I'm really sorry, I just...
I know, Jasmine said again.
I need to go. Can we stop for today?
Of course. You're the best gauge of your own mood. If you think it would be better to take a break and continue next time, then that's what we should do.
Okay,
Laura said and stood. She gathered her bag and her jacket and put a hand on the door handle. Behind her, she heard Jasmine Devane stand.
Laura, tomorrow, okay?
Laura, I want you to say his name for me.
I've got to go.
Say his name and we'll be done for the day. Say his name and count it a victory. It has no power over you.
Laura turned, and the warm, encouraging look on Jasmine's face melted her defenses.
Her therapist was just about her only friend. It was a thought so utterly sad, she had to fight off a bout of sudden manic laughter. When she spoke, the words came out so quietly they were almost gone before they arrived.
Eugene Hobbs.
Again, Jasmine said.
Eugene Hobbs,
she said, then turned and left the building. Mass murder trail leads to tragic past. Colin Smythe, Times staff writer, August 4th, 2017. Hillsboro, North Carolina. The gruesome trail left across North Carolina by Eugene Francis Hobbs began with a heartbreaking childhood, according to a new journal discovered by his ex-wife. A month has passed since the disappearance of Teresa Mitchum and the murder of Olive Hansen and the killings of Susan Gilroy, Alina Scopolotto, and Maria Mendelson occurred more than 3 decades ago. For many close to the case, it remains a harrowing, interminable experience. Their largest questions have always been the chief concerns of any murder investigation. Who and why? Eugene Francis Hobbs was born in 1948, deep in the Ouachitas, the remote mountains of Arkansas. It was a home birth onto a dirt floor, and he was a large baby. His mother bled to death within a few hours, long before any help could reach them. His father died in 1953, and Eugene and his brother, Charles, were sent to live with an uncle in East Texas. He joined the Army in 1966, and his fingerprints and photograph were taken as a matter of routine. The former would later be used to identify his body,
The latter depicts a squint-eyed young man with a crew cut and ghastly acne scarring. He married his first wife in 1975, and they divorced in 1976. In 1979, he married Aubrey Craig, with whom he had one daughter, and they divorced early in 1988. Between 1988 and 2017, when he was the victim of an apparent suicide, no record of his movements or activities has been found. His motives have remained shrouded in mystery, but a journal discovered by his second wife, a copy of which has been obtained by the Times, describes a devastating childhood and offers insight into the making of a monster. The journal records his earliest memory, shouldering the blame for the death of his mother. At the hands of his father and older brother, he was beaten, made to sleep outside, forced to eat raw meat, and required to defecate himself on command. His uncle, with whom he later lived, served 3 years in a Texas state penitentiary for sexual coercion of a minor. Hobbs relates the abuse he and his brother suffered at his uncle's hands, and how he was subsequently abused by his brother alone. According to his journal, Eugene Hobbs killed his brother when he was 18 and Charles was 21. His account has them driving back into Arkansas, up into the Ouachitas. With the help of a bottle of whiskey, a gun, and some strong handcuffs, he apparently subdued his brother, then forced him to dig a hole in the earth before choking him to death. Police sources have confirmed the discovery of a body, not as yet officially identified, at the location described in the journal. He remarried in 1979 and moved to Hillsboro, North Carolina, his new wife's hometown. In 1988, she filed for divorce, alleging abuse against their 10-year-old daughter, and obtained custody and a restraining order. Reports from those who knew him at the time portray a man with a strange antisocial personality, unhinged by the destruction of his family, and elements of the timeline seem to support that this was a pivotal moment. Not too long after the loss of his daughter, he met little Susan Gilroy. "They don't have anything to say," said the Gilroy family attorney, Lawrence Phillips. "You can imagine their state of mind." The families of the other victims did not respond to a request for comment. Chapter 23. Orange County Sheriff was an elected position, and Michael Fuller looked more like a politician than a lawman. His bespoke navy suit sported a subtle pinstripe, and his white dress shirt was of the starched, spread-collar variety. He had a forest green tie with a ruby stick pin, and a baby face split down the middle by a hooked nose of epic proportions. It worked for him, though. Without the nose, he would have been too perfect. With it, he played a very convincing everyman. He was up and around the desk before she finished opening the door. He stuck out a hand. Miss Chambers, how are you today? Fine, Laura said and put her hand in his. He squeezed it and held it, treating his captive to a 100-watt smile. His teeth were whiter than seemed natural, and he smelled of expensive aftershave. So sorry to have kept you waiting. Actually, I just got here. Where are my manners? Please, take a seat. He pulled out a leather club chair for her. She sat. You are the district attorney, right? He nodded. Let me assure you, Miss Chambers, that no one in my office, my old office, knew anything about the reports you made to my predecessor, or about the, adversarial nature of his response. He called me a liar and refused to even see my evidence. I think he was about this close. She held up her thumb and forefinger a quarter inch apart. To just throwing me in a cell. Fuller tutted disapprovingly. Terrible. If my office had known, believe me, we would have taken swift, decisive action. Pretty easy to say that now. He spread his arms. Considering I wasn't contacted at the time, this is the only chance I've had to say anything at all. You could have condemned McKinney for his mistake. Condemned? He's not on death row, Miss Chambers. One mistake does not a lifetime of public service negate. He cost lives. He killed Frank Stewart. Fuller tutted again, and this time it was aimed at her. Hardly. We all know who killed Deputy Stewart. Actually, that's why I'm... Fuller ran right over her with his resonant bass fricatives. That's not to diminish his mistake, you understand. He should have listened to you. No one is denying that. Didn't seem to stop him from winning a state Senate seat, Laura said. I can understand how that must be perplexing to someone with your experience of the man.
He came around the desk and poured two glasses of water from a crystal pitcher and placed one in front of her. But not everyone saw him that way. This is politics. Any publicity is good publicity. Even when a deputy gets killed? All's well that ends well. A savage threat to the public was dispatched. Lara's nose wrinkled in disgust. So Frank was what? An acceptable loss? Fuller stood again and yanked down on his lapels, straightening his jacket. When he spoke, the note of secrecy was gone from his voice. Of course not. No officer is expendable. But you and I are talking about an election, which is really just a matter of mathematics. Month after month, McKinney's name was all over the news because of that story. He paused. What do you think a candidate for state senate normally spends in this part of the state? I don't know. Fuller stared off into space, adding up the figures. Couple of hundred thousand, maybe? Like I said, I don't know. His eyes snapped back in her direction. Anyway, you can't buy advertising that good. His opponent didn't stand a chance. Lara wrung her hands. So basically, I got him elected. That's one way to look at it. Someone needs to hear what I have to say. Fuller returned to his chair and sat back, comfortable. No reason that can't be me. I'm all ears. I'm sure you've had a lot of people telling you everything there is to know about the Eugene Hobbs case. Investigators, evidence techs, probably even other reporters. Fuller raised one eyebrow. But among all those experts, I'm a very special and unique case. The only eyewitness. No one else was there. The boy, the photographer. He didn't come down to the cabin until after it was all over. I'm your only real eyewitness, and I'm here to clarify my statement. You see, in the context of the coroner's report, has that been made public? Lara frowned. I'm using it to help you understand the holes in the official narrative. Okay, Miss Chambers, now you've got me interested. I was a lawyer, remember? Digging holes in stories was my stock in trade. So what do you make of his legs? He smiled at her. You must still have a few sources to know about that. The coroner speculated that he hadn't walked in years. He shouldn't have done that, Fuller said. But his legs were quite atrophied, and it is suggestive. Still, he could have been in a wheelchair. No, she shook her head. That's exactly what I'm here to refute. I made a statement that night. A detective wrote it all down, and I signed it. I think seeing Deputy Stewart hurt like that, you were in shock. I wasn't thinking straight. A few days later, I actually read the damn thing. And it was wrong, Fuller said. No, it's technically accurate, but it misses a lot of nuances. Things that didn't seem important at the time become incredibly so, in light of the fact Eugene Hobbs didn't have use of his legs. Fuller frowned. Go on. Well, in my statement, it just says I saw him emerge from his hiding place in the leaves and go into the cabin after Stewart. That's correct, but it leaves out how he moved.
And how, may I ask, did he move?
Fluid, light, like an athlete. He ran to the cabin, but without making any real noise. The man I saw certainly was not in a wheelchair. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that Hobbs could walk. Even then, the man I saw wasn't anywhere near 70 years old.
How old would you say he was?
In his physical prime, 40 or under. Fuller tapped his pen against his temple.
Interesting.
It's a hell of a lot more than interesting. How does that square with an old man whose legs don't work?
So you're saying there was someone else up there?
Lara watched his face closely. This was the tricky part. I know how that sounds, she said. Pretend we're at trial. This is what they call a third man defense, right?
Certainly. The idea that the crime was committed by someone else entirely.
So maybe we could just, hypothetically, pretend I'm defending Eugene Hobbs, and I could lay out my trial strategy. He nodded, intrigued. I was there. I saw him move. I saw how it could have been done. The first thing you have to understand is the angle. The cabin stood with its front door facing us. Behind it was a shed. From up on high, I could just make out the shed's roof. Once I got down onto the ground, it was completely concealed behind the cabin.
They found electrical tape near Hobbs's body, and in the report they attribute it to the stock of the shotgun, which was wrapped in the same kind of tape. They assume some came loose, clumped together, fell on the ground. I have a different idea. I think our third man had Eugene Hobbs as a captive. I think he had him restrained in that shed. The shotgun already loaded and taped into his mouth so that when the time came... Laura brought her hands together and then threw them apart, mimicking an explosion. He could do it without delay, you see? She continued. And the torn bits of electrical tape would have been about all that was left. I mean, the shot tore apart his skull. How much tape would survive under those conditions? Hobbs's hands were restrained. His legs were useless. All he had to do was drag him out of the shed and pull the trigger. You've been up there? Fuller nodded. Someone shoved that door shut, and I had to fight my way out of the bedroom. Someone shoved a knife into Frank Stewart, got Hobbs out of the shed, killed him, and then pulled his finger through the trigger guard. It's also possible that Frank was already dead by the time I got to the cabin. But even if he wasn't, all that could have been done in 90 seconds. Maybe less. Fuller waited for her to continue, and when he saw she was done, said, "How long were you trapped in the bedroom?" "About that. Perhaps 2 minutes. I didn't look at my watch. In stressful situations, time seems to stretch. Is it possible what felt like 2 minutes was really a matter of seconds?" "No," Laura said. "I had to find the pickaxe and then physically break down the door. It took some time." Fuller nodded. "I can't say you're wrong, Miss Chambers. I wasn't up there. Things could have happened just the way you say they did." "You think I'm lying?" "You misunderstand me. You yourself didn't see what happened behind the cabin, so your version is speculative. I'm saying, yes, I can't prove that it didn't happen just that way. I also can't prove the real killer isn't John Wayne. You see, you're asking me to prove a negative." "God damn it, his legs didn't work. How can you explain it any other way?" Fuller leaned back in his chair and adjusted the knot in his tie. "I take issue with the idea that you're explaining it any better. You've had the chance to play defense attorney, so now let me play prosecutor. The essence of any third man defense is the narrative you tell a jury. Someone else committed the crime, and the story you tell has to cover all the normal bases, means, motive, and opportunity. I take it you don't have a potential suspect?" Laura's face burned. She shook her head. "Since we don't have an actual third man, we can't speak much to means or opportunity. So what about motive? We have Eugene Hobbs's journal. In it, he makes certain confessions, things that only the killer would know. Are you suggesting that he is not the person who killed Susan Gilroy, Alina Scopolotto, and Maria Mendelssohn?" "No, I'm not denying that. I'm saying he didn't kill Olive Hansen. He didn't take Teresa Mitchum. He lacked the means to commit these new crimes." "We've discussed that at length, and frankly, you have a point. If this was an actual trial, and I was his defense attorney, that right there might be my strategy. From that alone, I could manufacture reasonable doubt."
"But you still don't believe me."
"That's not it at all. You're focusing on flaws in the official narrative while ignoring the flaws in your own. Here's my point. What would be the reason for all this? If someone hates Hobbs, say, because they knew what he had done, why not just expose him?"
Laura said nothing.
"Why kill as him, only in service of revealing him? It's needlessly complicated, and it transforms our third man from a whistle-blowing hero into a child murderer. There's nothing to gain from such a turn, and everything to lose."
"I don't have all the answers, Sheriff, but what disturbs me is that I'm the only one looking for them. Maybe the official narrative is more correct than not, but no one is taking the time to actually investigate and find out. Everyone seems content to let sleeping dogs lie. Everyone was so busy getting elected, no one bothered to find out the truth."
Fuller frowned.
"Because what if I'm right? What then?"
The phone on the desk buzzed, and a voice rasped at him through the intercom.
"Your 3:30 is here."
Fuller pressed a button. "Tell him I'll be finished in just a moment." He looked at Laura and shrugged. "Duty calls."
"That's it?"
"Not at all," he said, getting up and walking toward the door. "I promise to look into it. Anything less would be unethical."
He opened the door, and she walked past him without a word.
"Goodbye, Miss Chambers." he called after her. She didn't bother to answer. Behind her, she could hear him glad-handing his next constituent. Everything was normal. Business as usual. The horror called Eugene Hobbs was already fading into the past. All's well that ends well. Everyone seemed to believe it. Everyone except Laura Chambers. Chapter 24. No shadows fell under the gunmetal gray sky. A cold wind shook the bare trees, and they swayed to its silent music. Laura wore a sheepskin coat cut to hang almost to her knee, and she pulled it close near her throat.
Can you sit?
He gave a quick, sharp bark.
Sit, Cooper, sit.
He sat.
You sure you have time for this?
Roger said. Bass Herman lets me come and go as I please. He about had an aneurysm when his photographer sold the only picture of the whole incident to a bigger paper, and Smythe leaving didn't help. Now he wants to forget the whole thing, just like everyone else. I'm getting assignments to write about prospective tax plans, or even worse, the weather. I'm supposed to be an investigative journalist.
So you come out here and talk to me, because no one else wants to give you the time of day.
I come, what, once a week?
Twice sometimes.
The field behind the house lay fallow, the rows of dirt extending into the distance. With no obstructions, the wind was as brutal as a club. It howled out of the northwest, slapping faces and numbing fingers. Rogers dug into the bag he carried and came out with a piece of cooked meat. She knew he'd collected it over the past few days, the fatty parts of steaks, the scrapings from a roast bone. Rogers looked at Cooper.
Stay.
Cooper sat, and Laura held his collar. Rogers walked away, zigzagging, making sudden sharp turns. Occasionally, after big movements, he scuffed the dirt with his toe. He ended up about 50 yards away at the stump of a tree that had never been pulled up. Coming back, he was careful to walk precisely the same path, using the scuff marks as a crude map.
Ready?
He asked Laura.
Yep.
Okay then, seek.
Laura released the collar and Cooper was off. He kept his nose pinned to the ground and moved in a circle around them. He'd seen Rogers walk to the stump, but it didn't seem to matter. He did it the same way every time, driven to complete the pattern, whether by his old training or by something ancient in his cells she didn't know. Halfway around, he found the scent of Rogers' trail, but kept moving, completing a full 360-degree pass. Rogers narrated,
Gotta make sure it's not a false trail.
Cooper swung back to the trail and started following it. The blasts of air from his nose were so intense that they threw up tiny dust clouds. Sometimes he would paw at a place.
Turns up scent. Stuff that might be hidden.
The bloodhound zigged and zagged, moving back and forth, always scanning for other clues. He reached the stump and stake, then threw back his head and bayed at the overcast sky.
Good boy!
Rogers shouted through cupped hands. Cooper snatched up the chunk of meat and lumbered over to them.
He still got it. I ever tell you about that time he found that boy down by the river?
Yep, Laura said.
How about that, Cooper?
He reached down and scratched him behind one ear.
I ran out of my own stories. Now I run out of yours, too.
She dug into her coat's other pocket and produced a thick sheaf of papers held together by an oversized paperclip. Here, take a look at the coroner's report.
What coroner's report?
The one from the crime scene, from the cabin in the mountains. He let out a low whistle.
The one on Eugene Hobbs? Where the hell did you get that?
Tominski owed me a favor.
I thought the deal was you getting to write the story. He didn't stop you.
He didn't exactly help me either. I called him that day, you know, and he was out chasing some dead end. I think he feels guilty.
Rogers stomped his feet. Could be guilt.
What else?
You two seem to get pretty close.
Laura shrugged. Who cares if he gives out copies of a little bit of paperwork? It's a closed case. The whole thing will be public record soon enough.
In my experience, the feds don't like things out in public until they are officially out in public, if you know what I mean. But you asked, and he did it anyway.
You jealous? That earned her another small smile.
Hell, I never had no federal agent do me any favors. Not even small ones.
Laura flipped through the pages until she found what she wanted.
Here, read.
Don't have my glasses.
Suffer through it, then. Rogers sighed and used his teeth to pull off one glove so he could turn the pages. He held the paper unnaturally far from his face and started reading. After a few minutes, he gave the low whistle again. Finished?
Yep.
Thoughts?
I think he's better off without a face. Nice to read a story with a happy ending.
Did you read the part about his leg?